right on. Somebody left some gourmet salt in the studio. I've been really getting into this stuff lately. I use Himalayan pink salt in my chili and Celtic gray salt at the table. I bet I can tell what this is just by tasting it. First of all, it's white, so that knocks out the Indian and Hawaiian stuff. I'm picking up either Spanish sea salt or Flor de Sel from Brittany. It's definitely not the Portuguese hand-harvested kind because that has a much brinier taste. But this isn't briny at all. I mean, it has more of a subtle saltiness. I love it. It really makes me feel good. You know what I would combine this with? Caramel. I only recently discovered what a wonderful combination that is. Chocolate and salt and caramel. That would be really good in ice cream, too. I wish I had an old-fashioned ice cream maker that you can crank by hand because I feel like I could really make a lot of it right now. Tucker, hey, I'm about to record here. What's going on?
Oh, here it is. This is the sample of street cocaine that the cops brought in for our 8-part series on the urban drug problem. You're supposed to take a photo of it and then they want it back.
That's not salt. I thought it was salt. Funny because it tasted really salty, but maybe I just had salt in my mind because we're doing a show today on the whole history of salt and the health issues around it. And the host of that show is a guy you could take with a grain of salt. Speaking of which, can I take a few grains of that salt before you wrap it up? Please, 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 please. Oh, the host of the show is Colin Mack. Ow, my head exploded. Say no to drugs, kids.
All right. So, salt is fine within moderation, but always make sure it's salt. I think that's the lesson of that intro. Make sure it is salt. We're going to be talking about salt today on a number of different levels across a series of different platforms and disciplines. We'll look at the history, the science, the cuisine uses of salt, the culinary uses, I guess that's the word I was looking for, of salt. And as we go along here, we hope that you will feel free to call in with your questions or comments, 860-275-7266. Somebody already is. 860-275-7266. So I'm looking forward to talking to Heidi from Martha's Vineyard, who has already called in. Let me tell you who's going to be on the show as we go along here. Mark Kurlansky, author of Salt, A World History. We could actually do like an entire week of Mark Kurlansky shows because his books are always like about something you could do a show about. We could do a show about nonviolence. We could do a show about the history of the song Dancing in the Streets. We could do a show about Hank Greenberg. I'm just doing these off the top of my head, but we could get a week's shows out of Mark just easy. Have him come here and stay. Anyway, you'll meet him in just a second. You'll also meet later on in the show Dr. Samuel Mann. He is the rock star of blood pressure medicine these days. He's professor of clinical medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital, the author of Hypertension and You, and not to make too big a deal out of it, but he's been on Oprah. Anyway, as we go along here, please give us a call, 860-275-7266. We're going to start, though, with Dr. Morton Satin. He is the vice president of science and research at the Salt Institute, which is sort of a trade association of various salt-involved industries, I guess. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Dr. Morton Satin, just off the top of the show, what is salt? Explain what it even is.
Oh, okay. Salt is sort of a natural molecule with sodium chloride. It's originally derived from the sea. We harvest it in a number of forms. Number one, regular sea salt, which is produced from fresh seas. Plus, we have evaporated salt, which actually comes from mine sources or sources. Geological sources which have been laid down over the eons from ancient seas that have dried up.
So it comes
in a couple of forms.
Okay, and that's what the chemical is. Is it a rock? Would we consider it a rock that we eat?
Yes, rocks. It's probably the only rock that we eat on a regular basis.
All right, so Mark Kurlansky, let's add you to the conversation in Salt, A World History. By the way, I will probably call you Paul at least once during this conversation because I went to school with your brother and he was a big influence on me.
At Kingswood?
Yes, at Kingswood. Oh. He was like 3 or 4 years ahead of me, and I started to talk like him because I was doing one of those hero worship things, and I still do it. Anyway, Mark Kurlansky, your book sort of looks at the role that salt plays really kind of in the foundation of any civilization. Any civilization, you say, needed, in ancient times, a salt source just to exist. Flesh that out for us a little bit.
Well, we all need, all human beings, all mammals, need a certain amount of sodium chloride, specifically sodium and chloride, for the functioning of cells and just for our bodies to work. We would die without it. Now, hunter-gatherers don't have any issues because they don't raise anything and They get all the salt they need just from their diet, which is almost entirely red meat. The rest of us need to get salt somehow. And if you are growing crops or raising animals, you need salt for them. And, you know, if your diet is a lot of grain and vegetables, you need salt added to it. You know, every civilization had this problem of how to get salt. But beyond the problem is the fact that before the age of refrigeration, you really didn't have any international commerce without salt, because you couldn't trade products unless they were salted, because they wouldn't be preserved. And before the Industrial Revolution, food products were a huge percentage of what was traded. So, you know, if you were a dairy farmer and you produced milk, you could sell it to your neighbors. But if you wanted to sell it abroad, you had to make cheese, which is a salted product that you can sell. Or, you know, same thing with fish, same thing with meat. So salt became essential to international economies. So basically every country and every culture in the world, except hunter-gatherers, has a salt story, a story of how they produce salt or how they got it if they didn't produce it.
Not only do they have a salt story, but you get the feeling, and reading your book, this becomes clearer, that salt loomed very large in their minds. So you have in the Bible, you know, you are the salt of the earth. You have the phrase, worth is salt, which seems to come
from...
Yeah,
I mean, salt was really important stuff. You know, you can go all over the world. I was recently visiting an enormous estate in Japan that was originally owned by a family that became wealthy because they controlled salt. I mean, salt was it was really important stuff and of great value. And so, yeah, it was thought about a lot by commercial people, but by governments. It became very political. It was, you know, part of foreign affairs. And you know, science was focused towards it. Geology was a science that was largely, until the 20th century, about trying to locate salt.
And not only geology, but, I mean, I think alchemy. I mean, in fact, salt became, for a lot of cultures, kind of woven into the fabric of metaphysics and religion to a certain degree, right?
Yeah, I mean, salt is kind of a natural for alchemy because, you know, I start believing in it when I think of salt because it's almost magical. It does so many things, you know. It can melt ice, but it can also assist in freezing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just has a huge number of properties and things that it can do.
What about today? Let's switch over to Dr. Morton Satin for just a second here from the Salt Institute. Well, obviously, it's not so important these days for the Roman army to be able to travel with salted meat. We don't need it to mummify bodies in Egypt. But what is salt used for today besides the obvious things?
Well, salt has got a number of applications. The largest application in North America is for road salt, obviously, to keep our roads clear and to keep us mobile and safe during wintertime. That's the single largest use of salt.
More salt is used that way than is used for culinary purposes?
Oh, yes, far more. About 60% of the salt market is for road salt.
Yeah, I mean, salt for eating is just a minuscule part of salt.
Yeah, a very tiny part of the market. You have salt used in water conditioning, salt used for animal nutrition as well. So there are a wide number of uses for salt, and food salt is actually one of the smallest uses.
All right. We're going to dive back into the past with Mark Kurlansky in just a second, but we've got some calls coming in here, and since we're just talking about the modern uses of salt and where people get their salt, here is indeed Heidi calling in from Martha's Vineyard, where she is a salt farmer. Hi, Heidi.
Hey there, Colin. Nice to meet you.
Well, nice to meet you, too. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I went to Hall, so I know a lot of people went to Kingswood.
Okay.
Shout out to Hall High and Kingswood. I'm calling because my husband and I, also from Connecticut, just started selling Martha's Vineyard sea salt this past May after 3 years of an investigation and learning a lot from people like Mark Kurlansky and Mark Bitterman.
And so explain what it is that you do there then. What if you're selling salt, if you're harvesting salt, selling salt, just to, you know, without necessarily giving us a full Mark Erlansky treatment on this, in 60 seconds, tell us how you do it.
What we do is we go to the sea, the fresh ocean, as Dr. Morton would tell you, and we collect the salt water. We bring it back to our farm where we run it through a filter to remove the brine shrimp, which we feed to our chickens and other things. And then we lay the water out in a fully enclosed building that we built to our own specifications, and then we allow the sun to do its thing, and it just evaporates the water, which is then condenses and is driven out of the building by a solar fan, and what we have as a result is salt, natural sea salt.
That is so awesome.
So your salt pond is covered.
That's correct, because in New England, unlike
right.
The islands, we have a lot of things like bugs and pollens and things like that. So it's 100% covered.
Well, also things like rain.
In rain, yes, it does rain quite a bit. Not this season, but usually.
I feel as though you should check the blood pressure of your chickens occasionally. I think they're probably eating a lot of salt when they eat that brine shrimp. But so that's really fascinating stuff. And it sort of raises a question for our guests right now, which is one of the things that people have been doing, obviously, is switching over to products like Martha's Vineyard sea salt, which sounds better and healthier. And I'm going to start with you, Mark Erlansky. One thing I've read about, I don't know if this is true or not, and I don't know whether you or Dr. Satin know the answer to this question, but I was reading today on some sites that sell various kinds of gourmet salt, and they were saying that if you buy sea salt in the grocery store, it may be actually a byproduct of desalination somewhere, which made me think I probably would want to buy Martha's Vineyard sea salt instead. But one of the, there's like people.
Well, you know, sea salt in this country is greatly mythologized because it's rare. Most American produced salt isn't sea salt, but most salt in the world is sea salt. Because, you know, therefore all sea salt in this country is either extremely rare or foreign imported. You know, it has this cachet, and often people have great expectations, which are really based on nothing.
Except the Martha's Vineyard sea salt is, I think, pretty awesome.
I mean,
I mean, don't rain on their salt pond, Mark, you know?
No,
there's no standard.
I think that I'm all in favor of little artisanal projects, but what I'm saying is that, you know, the basic people have this general idea that if it's sea salt, it's better.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily true.
All right. Well, I'm still clinging to that idea. Dr. Satin, I heard you sort of jumping in there. One of the things that we're sort of used to is looking on the label of something to see how much sodium is in it. You know, those of us who are worried about our sodium. But one of the things that I was reading about getting ready for this show is it's sometimes less clear what's actually in salt or table salt or sea salt.
Okay, first of all, sea salt is not standardized. There is no standard for sea salt because you have so many thousands of varieties of sea salt produced around the world. Most of them artisanal. Several of them are commercial. There is no standard for sea salt. It can vary anywhere from 65% sodium chloride all the way up to 99.999%, just like evaporated salt. So it varies all over the map. But in a sense, that's good because, I mean, sea salt has a certain amount of romance to it, and it's good that we're seeing small entrepreneurs taking advantage of the current market situation and producing individual products. In terms of sodium, of course, they will vary all over the map. You know, consuming sea salt is absolutely no guarantee of having anything that's low sodium.
No.
Even low sodium in a single product is not defined.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, you know, maybe it's helpful to point out that sodium chloride is white. So any salt that isn't white has things in it other than sodium chloride. Whether these things are good or not, you know, is open for debate and, you know, depends what we're talking about. But, you know, colored salts are colored because they have impurities. And before the 20th century, before there was an ability to standardize a lot of salt, the great goal was, you know, how white can you get your salt? And the whiter the salt, the more desirous it was. And then, you know, we started living in this world where most salt was white, and then we became intrigued with all these other things. So you have this gray salt from Garonne in Brittany, and people are very drawn to it, and they market it brilliantly. And, you know, nobody remembers that Louis XIV's Minister of Finance, Colbert, wrote to them and said, I wish you could get this stuff whiter. We could sell a lot more.
Dr. Morton Satin, also, when I buy table salt, though, I read this somewhere today. I've been reading all kinds of things about salt. I don't know how many of them are true. But table salt has something, often has something in it besides sodium chloride, right, to increase porability. There are other things that are added.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. Table salt contains anti-caking agent. So that, you know, there's always a little bit of moisture around, and salt has a tendency, as it absorbs moisture, it's hygroscopic, to get clumpy. Mm. Anti-caking agents improve the porability of the salt.
It's not the same as it used to be. What's the anti-caking agent?
The caking agent is different?
Yeah.
Like how?
You know, I don't remember off the top of my head, but there was something, whatever it was that was used for an anti-caking agent isn't used anymore, and something else is used instead.
Do you know, Dr. Satin, what the change was?
Well, there are several different types of anti-caking agents that are all approved by the FDA. So there's a choice. It depends on the maker.
All right. So I don't want to get hung up on anti-caking agents because we could just talk all day about that, obviously. I want to just go back into history with you a little bit, too, because there's all kinds of stuff that we're leaping over. And the book is really fascinating and has so many different sort of little side trips and things we're not going to have time to talk about today. I mean, even the Tabasco sauce turns out to be connected to the history of salt somehow. But let's talk about a couple of kind of really big things. First of all, there's, you know, an expression. You know, back to the salt mines, and I never really gave too much thought about salt mines and where they are and what role that they play. But even in the American Civil War, salt mines were significant and worth destroying, right? Do I have that right?
Oh, yeah. It was a policy of the North, of the Union Army, to destroy salt works in the Confederacy wherever they could. And they did this very effectively, and there was a tremendous salt shortage in the South, which was a huge problem because it meant that it was hard to provision for the winter, and including for the Confederate Army to provision. And, you know, basic foods like hams and salted meats and, you know, cured food weren't available. This was a crisis. You go back and you look at Southern newspapers during the Civil War, and they're full of this, and they try to offer recipes for ways of getting around salt because there was no salt. And it was a very effective Union policy to hurt the South.
No, it's also sort of connected to various kinds of revolutionary activities, whether it's in India and France. And let's tell both those stories, starting in France. In France, the monarchy taxed salt, but apparently at different rates in different regions, leading to salt smuggling?
Yeah, because, you know, it's the way France, like many European countries, was put together. You know, they would acquire a duchy here, a little kingdom there, a little republic there. And as they acquired these different entities, they negotiated different deals for entry into France. And one of the things that was negotiated was the salt tax. So some parts of France had much higher salt taxes than others. Brittany was able to negotiate a pretty good deal, but you cross the Loire and you're not in Brittany, so it means that one side of the Loire has much more expensive salt than the other side. So, you know, whenever you have a border with a cheaper product on one side than the other side that's restricted, you create smuggling. So the French prisons were full of people who had been arrested for salt smuggling. And it became a very volatile issue and a key issue in the French Revolution, so that at the time after the monarchy was overthrown and the Assemblée Nationale was declared, one of the first things they did was abolish the salt tax.
And very quickly, and we're obviously having to sort of compress this, but I think people do probably have some vague memory of Gandhi's March to the Sea. I don't know if it's the same as the Confederate South, but it seems like salt is especially valuable in very sweaty climates where you're going to be losing a lot of salt.
Yeah, well, this is a slightly different kind of issue. This was, you know, I mean, most Gandhi trying to fight was colonialism, and so he pondered, you know, what you could do in a very simple way to get people to rise up against colonialism. And he thought of salt, because under the British colonial laws, the Indians were not allowed to make salt. They were forced to buy Cheshire salt, to buy British salt, which was much, much more expensive. So salt was unreasonably expensive in India, where they could have just made it themselves, but they weren't allowed to. So he announced that he was going to go make salt illegally. And he marched to the sea, and he got people to follow him. And, you know, he was great at this stuff. He made sure all the press was along on the trek, and that the photographers were on hand when he just scooped up a bunch of salt from the shore and held it in the air, thereby having illegally made salt and defied British colonialism. And it was extremely popular. It worked. It did a lot to get people to rise up and join Gandhi's cause.
It's what they now call great optics.
Yes.
And good optics. And there were people on both sides of the question, on the Raj side and on Gandhi's side, who thought he was picking the wrong fight, that it should be about land use or land use taxes or something else. And he said, no, everybody needs salt. Everybody uses salt.
Right. A lot of people thought, a lot of people in his movement, you know, thought this was absolutely crazy. And he said, no, you know, this is what people care about. Because he understood, you know, that the average Indian wasn't a landowner, but he was a guy who needed salt.
We've got a call. Our number, 860-275-7266. Once again, 860-275-7266. Talking about salt, we've got a call here. It's probably a question for Dr. Morton Satin. Let's just see. Keith in Hartford, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I had a quick question for you.
Okay.
You've been talking about how important it was, or how important sea salt is, and the March to the Sea from Gandhi and everything. But it's been drilled into my head since I was a child. If you're ever stranded at sea or anything along those lines, you do not drink the seawater because of the abundance of salt. So I was just curious about the science behind that.
Let's take Dr. Satin on that one.
Well, you can't drink seawater because you have to be able to eliminate sodium chloride. You have to be able to dilute it down. And unless you have fresh water coming into the system, you're continually increasing the amount of salt that you have and putting a load on the kidneys that is unbearable for them. That's the reason why you can't drink sea salt. Mind you, you can drink sea salt in a small portion, but it's very, very strange. Salt's a very strange thing. I mean, if you have salt and water, by the way, it's not particularly agreeable. But if you have the same level of salt in chicken soup, even in very, very thin chicken soup, it all of a sudden becomes a very agreeable taste. So it's kind of a strange thing. But you definitely shouldn't be drinking sea salt.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Drinking seawater. Yeah. Sorry.
So this is
everything in moderation. Thank
about
you.
About the importance of chicken soup.
Right.
Yeah. We actually are. We'll swing back into the pot of chicken soup. We're going to take a little break here in just a second. When we come back, we'll be, I think, adding Dr. Samuel Mann to our conversation. Talk about the fact that people are worried a little bit about salt. Time for our break. One Betsy Kaplan. Two Betsy Kaplan. Three Betsy Kaplan.
We're going to clean up the barn and we'll have a lot of fun. Roll salt on the floor. You spread it all around, and then you do the salty boogie to the salty sound. Shuffle on the salt, boogie on the salt.
All right, we're back. We're talking about salt. You make a phone in with questions, 860-275-7266. I feel as though we will have the answer. We have Mark Kurlansky, who wrote Salt, A World History. We recommend that book. Dr. Morton Satin is here with us, Vice President of Science and Research at the Salt Institute, joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Joining us now also is the rock star of blood pressure. His name is Dr. Samuel Mann. He's professor of clinical medicine at New York Presbyterian Hospital and Weill Cornell Medical College. He's a specialist in hypertension. I call him the rock star of blood pressure. It's the same thing. He's the author of Hypertension and You, a book I actually have in my house, often next to my bedside. And it's the best book ever about hypertension. So, Dr. Mann, well, I'm sure we'll also hear from our other guests about this, but Dr. Mann, welcome to the show. And second of all, for people like me, I mean, I actually have blood pressure that I take a drug to control. And so I'm constantly thinking about salt, looking at the sides of boxes of things to see how much salt, how much sodium is in it. But I also know from reading your book that hypertension is actually sort of a bunch of different things in some ways. It has all kinds of different origins, things that can be causing it. So how much of my salt phobia, my salophobia, is actually warranted?
It's a difficult question to answer because different people are different. I'd say about a quarter of people, salt is a factor in their blood pressure, and reducing their salt intake will lower their pressure. As we get older, that percentage is higher. African Americans, the percentage is higher, probably half or more. In those instances, reducing salt can lower blood pressure. Reducing salt can reduce the amount of medication you need if you need medication. But clearly, it's not the only mechanism of hypertension.
Have we reached a point where we're actually too worried about salt and not worried enough about everything else that might play into a hypertension scenario?
When people ask me about that, if one eats a healthy diet, by its nature, it's lower in salt. And you can take the same diet, and it's good for hypertension, good for overweight, good for diabetes, good for coronary disease. And it's a natural diet, more fruits and vegetables, less in the way of grease, less in the way of the starches, the bread and the cake and all that. That diet will be lower in salt. Obviously, eating in restaurants adds salt to it. I think salt is an issue. Excessive salt is associated with adverse outcome, but it's not something I would be fanatic about.
One more question for you, and then I'm going to sort of swing back to our other guests and get their perspectives on this too. But I think the other problem for somebody like me, okay, I am a little conscious about my salt. I do worry about it. So there are things that I can look on the side of, a can of soup, a package of frozen foods. I would, by the way, tell people who shop at Trader Joe's and buy those frozen preparations, look at the sodium content on some of them. It seems astronomical, at least by the recommended daily dose standards. But there are other ways in which one ingests salt that one is not aware of. I mean, I'm guessing if I buy a bagel, I'm probably getting a lot of salt that isn't on any label that I can look at. I mean, if I just walk into Brugger's or someplace and get a bagel. Maybe, Dr. Mann, you can just give us a sense. Where does salt tend to turn up in our diet?
Okay, well, I'll start out by saying the least of the salt that we take is what we add in the salt shaker. That's about 20% or less. Most of it comes, as you said, the soups are horrendous offenders, obviously salty foods like chips and pickles and olives, canned and frozen. Some frozen is low sodium, so one has to check the label because some are high in sodium and some are not. The bread, the bagels, the baked goods are high in salt. Cereal has more salt than people think. Interestingly, the condiments, ketchup is high in salt. Surprisingly, mustard is low in salt. The mustard seed doesn't have salt in it unless it's a preparation that adds salt to it, making a mustard sauce. So there also, the contents will be there, but mustard per se is actually low salt.
So I want to just get some other soundings on this. And Dr. Morton Satin, obviously you work for the Salt Institute, so you're probably not in the business of telling us that salt overall is terrible for us. Where does the Salt Institute come out on this whole question of salt in people's diets?
Well, there's a number of things. Number one, because we're the Salt Institute, we have to really, really carefully refer to the evidence. It's not our evidence, it's the evidence that's out there. Let me tell you a couple of things about salt and diet, because I spent most of my life in the food industry, only recently with the Salt Institute. The most heart-healthy diet in the world that's always talked about is the Mediterranean diet, which has about 40% more salt than our diet over here. The reason why it's heart-healthy is because you're eating a variety of foods. You're eating far more vegetables and salads. Don't forget the word salad means sal, S-A-L, salted vegetables. Salads, green vegetables, more fish, other things. It's a much more balanced diet, number one, and they also have a lifestyle associated with it. So their cardiovascular metrics are great. It's the one thing that when Ancel Keys did this seven-country study, he totally avoided the issue of sodium, because, in fact, sodium is very high in the Mediterranean diet. And it's because they eat so many traditional foods. We eat less salt now than any time in recorded history. I'm not going to go back before things were recorded and analyzed. I can only deal with the evidence that's available. And recorded history goes back about 200 years. And the only place I've been able to find the actual data has been in military archives, because they were very, very careful about the amount of foods that they gave to people, to their soldiers and to prisoners of war. And from the War of 1812 until the end of the Second World War, from the prisoners of war that were kept in Dartmoor Prison in England, the American prisoners of war, to the American prisoners of war that were kept in the Stalags in Germany, the records show that they ate between 18 and 20 grams of salt per day, which is at least double the amount of salt that we currently consume.
But they probably didn't have blood pressure cuffs there, you know.
No, they didn't.
Who knows? It could have been 160 over 120.
It could be. But the fact was that traditionally, historically, we ate far more salt than we do now, at least in recorded history. That's all I can deal with. After the war, in the 10-year period after the war, as Mark mentioned, we switched over. The major role of salt in food as a preservative was overtaken by refrigeration. So in the 10 years after the war, we dropped our salt consumption by about half. By 1955, 56, 57, our salt consumption dropped to half, and it has remained there until today. It has not changed. It has not gone up. I know most people think that processed foods have more salt. But in fact, we're not consuming more salt. Every gourmet food that you can think of was preserved in salt. Every gourmet food that we eat now was preserved in salt. And if you take a look at the Mediterranean diet, all the cheeses, the botarga, the prosciuttos, capers, olives, whatever, all preserved in salt.
Yeah, you're very passionate about this, Dr. Satin, I can tell. Hey, I want to swing it over to Mark Kurlansky just for a second here. This is something you've looked at, too.
Especially this issue, because people keep asking me about it. I think that he's right, that we, in the past, ate more salt than we do now. But, you know, I'm not sure of that. The problem with all of this stuff is we talk about people like they're all the same. I was very happy to hear Dr. Mann, because it's so nice to have a distinguished doctor confirming everything I've been arguing for years. You know, people are all different. They have different medical problems, and they have different eating habits. Now, if you have somebody who's absolutely obsessed with industrial food, they may be having one of the highest salt consumptions in history. But on the other hand, myself, I don't eat any of that stuff. So it's really kind of hard to say. But the basic diet, certainly in the past, was much heavier in salt than it is today. Unfortunately, there wasn't the medical knowledge to see if it resulted in, if there was a medical consequence for it. But as Dr. Mann points out, you know, some people can eat lots of salt with impunity and others not. And, you know, the fact that you have high blood pressure doesn't necessarily mean that you got it from salt or that not eating salt will improve it. So, you know, there's a lot of people in public health and in politics who want things to be very simple. And they're not. They're very complicated. And there are no easy solution. You can't turn around American health by, you know, forcing the food industry to use less salt. It's just nonsense.
Dr. Samuel Mann, I'm going to swing it back to you for a second here. I mean, first of all, I have to say that I keep telling the producers on my show I want to do an entire show about blood pressure, and I want to have Dr. Samuel Mann on it, and they look at me like I'm crazy. And that's the part about you, the part about doing an entire show about blood pressure. But but it's really interesting stuff. And one of the things that's really clear reading your book is that a lot of people are probably on the wrong drug. And this isn't a show about high blood pressure or hypertension, but it's sort of worth pausing over for a second. There's a lot of people, even in some of the ways that Mark just said, you know, they might be on a diuretic or something like that for their blood pressure, when in fact it's not really related to anything like that, and when in fact their salt intake has nothing to do with their blood pressure. How do they figure that out, assuming you don't have any appointments free for the next couple of weeks?
How do they figure out, is a diuretic the right or wrong?
Yeah, thing? Yeah, or does salt play any role in this? I mean, how do they figure out what kind of hypertension they have?
You know, ideally, there are certain clues that can tell you. One clue is how much salt a person consumes, which can contribute to blood pressure. We don't measure that accurately because the 24-hour urine collection is a pain, and it's not often done, although even from a spot urine, some of my research, we've shown you can estimate 24-hour sodium intake from a spot urine. Also, ethnicity, blacks are more likely to be salt sensitive. Older patients are more likely to be salt sensitive. And those are the people who are more likely to respond to a diuretic. There's also some guesswork. I would also say among people whose hypertension has not responded to drugs, you could bring it under control in half of cases by strengthening the diuretic regimen. So salt and volume have a lot to do with certain populations. And I would agree with Dr. Kurlansky, one size doesn't fit all. If salt and retention of salt isn't controlling, if retention of salt is not responsible for your blood pressure, the diuretic may be the wrong drug for you. I'd like to add a couple of points to the comments that were made. First of all, as far as the high salt intake in previous generations only had a lifespan of 50 years, maybe 60. We're trying to prevent strokes and heart attacks from years down the road. And to my knowledge, Japan, which has a very high, has had a very high salt intake, had the highest stroke rate. Every study, there are conflicts between study results, and you can argue ad nauseum about which study is reliable and which isn't. There's one thing that almost every study agrees on, is that a very high salt intake is associated with cardiovascular events, and there's no study that shows that a very high salt intake is beneficial.
Can I ask you a question,
comments.
Dr. Mint?
Yeah, we should also say, Dr. Mint, you've made Mark Kurlansky's parents very happy by giving him the medical degree that that he
served. I thought you were recognizing my honorary PhD.
Hey, go ahead, Mark.
You know, there are all these studies that there's one that had a big response from the American Heart Association on the amount of people who die from excessive salt intake, but. Am I correct in thinking that there really is no scientific way of saying that somebody died from eating excessive salt? I mean, you can say that they died from hypertension, and you can note that they had a very high salt diet, but you can't really say that salt killed them. Is that right?
In order to answer that, you'd have to do a study that is impossible, and that would be to take, let's say, 1,000 people and randomize half to a low-salt diet and half to a higher salt diet, and have them maintain that diet for the next 20 years, and then follow up and see who had more events. That can't be done.
And who gets to choose which go to which group?
Oh, it's randomized. You have no choice. You're assigned, and then you have to stick to it. And that's the kind of study you would need to prove it, and that kind of study is impossible. The other problem, aside from that, is that if you have somebody who has a high salt intake and as a result has a higher blood pressure and needs more medicine, his doctor is going to give him more medicine. So then you're looking at, all right, if you have somebody on a low salt diet and less medicine with the same blood pressure as somebody with a higher salt diet on more medicine, obviously we would like to minimize medicine, but we don't have any evidence that one is worse off than the other.
And actually, Mark, we're doing that study right now with macaques on the second floor of this building, but we don't like to talk about it too much. We have to take a quick break here. I have a funny feeling that Dr. Zatin is going to want to say something about this, but I got to get the break in here. We'll come back. Thanks so much to Dr. Samuel Mann. We will be talking to him in the future when we do our all blood pressure show. Let us know. You're clamoring for this, aren't you?
Please pass me the salt. I need some salt. Would you want a little salt? I took no for a gun. Don't use the lie.
I've just come back from a salt tasting and my mouth is kind of dry. There. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our interns, Garrett Connolly and Albert Gordon. Greg Hill is our Tweetmaster Flash. Don't push him, because he's close to the edge. Voiceover help in the intro by Tucker Ives. The part of Bill Curry was played by the Morton Salt Girl. On tomorrow's show, is work the best place to work? And now, back to Colin.
So a couple of things right there. First of all, I should have mentioned this earlier. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin, and you may follow the fascinating tweets that Greg Hill's doing right now at WNPR Colin on the Twitter. Also, yeah, tomorrow we're going to be talking about workspaces. We have the capacity, obviously, to work almost anywhere these days, but people still congregate in physical workspaces like the one that I'm in right now. We're going to talk about why they work sometimes, why they don't, why they're necessary, why they're not, what to do about interruptions. What's the current state of thinking about the physical workspace? That's our show tomorrow. If you have ideas about that, by the way, or a workspace that you're in these days that either really works very well for you or does not, you can email me right now at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. All right, that's enough about that. Back to salt. We should just say with us still is Mark Kurlansky, or Dr. Mark Kurlansky, as he now is, author of Salt, A World History, and Dr. Morton Satin, the Vice President of Science and Research at the Salt Institute, a trade association for salt producers and salt companies. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. So, Dr. Satin, we were talking before about the whole question. Mark asked a question about whether you can die from eating just too much salt. Dr. Mann had one answer. I could just tell from the rustling down the line that you wanted to talk a little bit about this.
Thank you. There's a couple of things. I'm really sorry Dr. Mann is off, because I did want to tell him that the latest research actually published 2 months ago indicates that there is, in fact, a very, very rapid test to replace this 24-hour urine for sodium. It was carried out by the group at the University of Virginia and published in Clinica Chimica Acta. The point is there's a very rapid way of determining which people are sensitive to salt, and what they're doing right now is scaling it up. Okay, now let's go back a bit. We talked about Japan. The highest rate of strokes are in Japan. Well, of course, there are many, many risk factors for strokes. What was not mentioned, even though the Japanese are the highest consuming population of salt in the world, they're also the longest-lived population in the world. Now, we'll always say there's a whole bunch of confounding factors that lead to their longevity. Fact is their longevity isn't in it's not out of keeping with the amount of salt that they consume. In other words, there's no conflict between the amount of salt that they consume and the very long lives that they have. So what we deal with is a tremendous amount of urban mythology, and I spent half of my time trying to get things back in order. One of the things that was said by Dr. Mann was that in the past we lived a lot, our lifespan wasn't nearly what it is now. Well, if you take a look at the USA population statistics going back to 1835, and you look at those statistics compared to now. Well, of course, the key was birth rates. Your population expectation at when you're born was, let's say, I don't know, 55 years. If you manage to live the first 10 or first 15 years of your life, then you find that, in fact, the lifespan figures between then, back in 1835, and now, because it's available, it's all available on the web. These are government websites. You find out that there's only about 4 or 5 years difference. In 100, over 170 years that we've only, with all the advances in medicine, we've only been able to extend our life expectancy after the age of, let's say, 15 or 20, 4 or 5 years. The key was, is the determining factor for life expectancy was infant mortality.
But I think we're throwing out a figure
doesn't mean anything.
True, but I think we're getting down a little bit of a blind alley here.
In terms of the amount of salt that you can consume, salt is self-limiting. It's as simple as that. Nobody eats more salt. you can't have foods that are too salty. So if you go up to a certain amount, let's say 7,000 milligrams of sodium, let's say 15, 20 grams of salt per day, generally speaking, nobody can eat that much salt. If you take a look at the actual figures, there's a U-shaped curve. It's called a J-curve, Bertrand's curve, which describes the impact of salt on life health outcomes. At the low end, when you're eating very, very, very little salt, you have very, very bad health outcomes. It's an essential mineral. It's an essential nutrient. You don't eat enough, you will die. As simple as that. And then there's this flat area, this very, very broad, flat, safe area, that all the data that we have shows, well, if you eat in this broad range, and by the way, Americans are in slightly less than the middle of that range, then you have the least amount of health outcomes. Now, health outcomes is not just hypertension or stroke. It's the whole series. It's diabetes. It's all sorts of other things. I mean, our life we can't have hypertension myopia when it comes to diet.
Absolutely. You know, Dr. Sadden, I just want to wrap this part of it up because we're just about to run out of time, and it's like all we're talking about right now. I mean, let me grab one quick call from John, and then I want to go back to Mark for just a second. Hi, John.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Sure. I just had a quick question. At dinner, sometimes I say pass the road salt because we got this sort of fake salt that you can get, which is potassium chloride, sometimes I guess magnesium chloride. And I just want to know if they had an opinion on that. I don't understand why it wouldn't also raise blood pressure because it's some minerals in the blood, but it's not sodium, so it's like free salt.
Good question. Dr. Satin, did you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. Whatever you're consuming, potassium has a mitigating impact on blood pressure. Although potassium is bitter, it's not like salt. The thing is, you should be getting your potassium from a balanced diet, from vegetables, from salads.
Yeah, but I think he just wants to impart a somewhat salty taste to things, and so thinks that maybe this is
yeah, well, salad. You know, you put in a little less salt and eat it on salad.
All right.
And you'll be far better off.
Yeah,
go ahead, Mark. Yeah.
He called them fake salts. They aren't fake salts. There's lots of different kinds of salts, you know, and these are all salts. Sodium chloride is just the one that we prefer to eat.
Yeah, I noticed that actually. I was in a long bike trip in Europe this year, and people were cramping up and taking salt tablets, except that when you're in Germany and you get the kinds of things that you would get as a salt tablet around here, it has like magnesium. they have like a whole different idea of what kind of salt that we need. So maybe some of it's culturally conditioned. Hey, you know, just really quickly, Mark, and we just have only about 90 seconds left here. I wish we'd had more time for this. But really quickly, there's delving way back in history. One of the things we didn't touch on is there's sort of an odd relationship between finding salt and finding oil. Back in the old days, like drilling was invented to find salt. But yeah, just for 60 seconds, give us a little riff on that.
Yeah, well, this particularly has to do with a geological formation called a salt dome, which is called a dome because it pushes out in a dome shape on the surface. And it can go down miles, solid sodium chloride, a column of it. And which, of course, geologists were always looking for because that's a lot of salt. But it turns out that often next to it is a lot of oil. And all of the early oil discoveries were made by salt domes, because oil is organic material over time, and it hits this impermeable wall of salt, and it develops into oil. And so the oil industry really grew on looking for salt domes.
So if you want to know if there's oil in your yard, lick the ground, and if it tastes salty, you got a good.
Yeah, I'm not sure it works.
No, it doesn't work. And you should read Mark's book. There's so much other stuff in there. You'll find out why places like with names like Norwich and Greenwich have some kind of connection to salt. All kinds of really interesting stuff. We got to stop for today. Thanks so much to Dr. Samuel Mann and Dr. Morton Satin. Mark will be back tomorrow for our show on Hank Greenberg, and then on Thursday he'll be on for the show about nonviolence. We'll be doing a show with him next Tuesday about dancing in the streets. It's all Kurlansky Radio all the time here on WNPR. Special thanks to Wolfie for putting this show together and everybody who helped out.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and I'm so excited. My Acme brand Play-Doh just arrived in the mail, and I am starving. Wow. This aftermarket crap is salt-free. What's the point of even buying Play-Doh if you're not going to eat it?